Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 2 of the Runner's World podcast. Each month we'll be bringing you training advice, news and interviews from the wide world of running. I'm Rick Pearson, the Runner's World section editor, and I'm here with my co-host Ben Hobson, the digital editor. Ben, what have we got coming up on this month's episode?
On this month's podcast, we have Sean Conway, the adventurer, who's just completed the running part of his Length of Britain triathlon. We have Peter Thompson, who is running the entire length of this year's Tour de France route. And we have commissioning editor Kerry McCarthy to advise on running kit ahead of the marathon.
One of the more interesting emails that came into my inbox this week was about the length that runners will go to get a kind of performance advantage. So it said, check this out. So 35% of runners would be willing to down pickle juice to run further.
Sure.
29% would swallow baking soda. I think this is weird, but not that weird at this point, right? But here we go. 24% would munch on caterpillar fungus. And 13% would eat blood custard. Right. And best of all...
Hold on, what's blood custard?
I'm not sure. 10% would drink... this is apparently serious. Deer penis wine, to be faster.
I'm not even sure what that is.
I don't know what that is.
I'm also concerned... So, caterpillar mould?
Yeah, caterpillar
fungus.
So
not just caterpillars?
No.
No, that's just too run-of-the-mill.
Yeah, fungus. Caterpillar fungus.
It's got to be the fungus.
Got to be the fungus part. So I thought that was... I mean, what's wrong with a banana and an energy gel?
I mean, surely a banana is the safest bet of all of those things.
But no, apparently, no, 10% were up for deer penis wine. So I thought that was...
What is it?
Well...
Is it just the wee of a deer?
Possibly. We'll have to look into this a bit more. But I was pretty...
I thought people drinking loads of beetroot juice was weird.
Runner's World Podcast.
Having already cycled and swum the length of Britain... Endurance adventurer Sean Conway completed his trilogy by running all the way from John O'Groats to Land's End. He completed the journey entirely unsupported, sleeping in a tent and carrying all his own equipment. I caught up with Sean to hear about his journey and why he thinks we should seek out adventures on our own. So your new book, Running Britain, comes out next month. What's that all about?
Well, Running Britain is the third and final leg of my... Length of Britain triathlon, I think, is what it landed up being. But totally by mistake, if I'm honest. 2008, I cycled Land's End John O'Groats. After hearing about the record, which is 44 days, I thought, right, how close can I get to 44 days? Turns out not close at all. Sorry, 44 hours. It took me 25 days to do it. And then years later, I then swam Land's End John O'Groats. And it was only after those two that I thought, right, but I've got to do the triathlon now. And not being a runner at all, I actually failed the first attempt because I got injured taking a selfie, which was pretty embarrassing.
But we've all been there.
We've all been there, yeah. Nevertheless, carried on 6 months later and had a second crack at it. Truthfully, it was never meant to sort of be this big epic run. I had 6 weeks off and I wanted to make the most of all 6 weeks, so you know, did my route accordingly and just explored Britain via trails, and it was amazing.
So the first attempt, you got injured. I mean, had you been running much beforehand, or was running sort of fairly new to you at that point?
Oh yeah, running was very new. I mean, I did running at school. I did a bit of cross country and, you know, I was okay at the sort of 800 meters, but that's the last time I pretty much ran, other than for a bus, you know,
right.
In my 20s. It was only when I was in my early 30s that I took up running again, sort of went and bought my first pair of trainers, which is why I got injured. You know, as all proper runners know, it takes a while to build up all your cartilage strength and your hard tissue and all that sort of thing. And so I was pretty new to it, which is why I was really struggling at the beginning, especially wearing a 10kg rucksack as well. That didn't help things.
Yeah, right, I'm sure. I think it's amazing the fact that you obviously as well, that the premise of the run was that you were going to explore routes perhaps less trod. What did you learn about running through Britain in that way on trails?
Oh, man, I mean, I always say it and I'll keep on banging on about it. Britain is the best island in the world, man. You know, there's just so much going on. There's so many hidden little things that you only hear about once you kind of go out there. And often find them, you know, hidden away on these little trails, like little, you know, those people who have opened up little cafe and potteries, you know, on the Great Glen Way, which you would never know about unless you actually walk that trail. The West Highland Way, you come across some amazing little places and small little towns, and places like at Cape Wrath Lighthouse, there's a cafe that'll open for you any time of day. You rock up at 2 a.m, the cafe owner will open up and make you a soup. It's amazing.
That's brilliant.
And it's exploring that, all those little hidden places. And because when I did the cycle, I explored the roads. When I did the swim, I explored the coastline. And for the run, I really wanted to explore the trails. And you know, there are, you know, tens, if not hundreds of thousands of miles of public footpaths and bridleways and byways all over Britain. And it was amazing to explore them.
Did you have any real standout moments?
Oh, everywhere, you know. I mean, at the top, going across the north coast of Scotland is pretty gnarly, and then you start sort of heading south. I didn't want to go east and down the A99 because it's pretty busy. So I went across the top a bit. And then you're down into kind of cutting through all the backlands, which is pretty remote. That bit of Scotland is one of the most uninhabited parts of Europe, believe it or not. And it really does feel it, especially when you do it in March. It's really cold.
Sure.
And then you're into sort of the West Highland Way and the Great Glen, which is just amazing. And from there, you're down into Glasgow and you do all the borders, which are, again, incredible. Then you're in the Lake District. Then you're on all the canals. You can pretty much do canals from Kendal all the way to Bristol, pretty much. In fact, you can definitely. It's a bit windy, so I did cut some corners just to save my knees on the mileage. Then the canal way. I love canals. I lived in an old World War II gunboat on the River Severn for 3 years, which I have an affinity for lots of algae and swan poo. You know, run along canals.
So I mean, this is quite a big route, and as you say, you can track it pretty much via canals or on sort of these pathways that just need exploring. But did you run with technology? How did you map this?
Well, at the beginning stages, I have a massive map of Britain at home, which I can put sort of a whiteboard marker on and rub it out. So I was sort of looking at various routes on paper maps at home. But just for weight, I actually then did everything via the Ordnance Survey app on my phone.
Right.
And that shows you exactly where all the trails are and things like that. And that was the easiest way to navigate while on the road. And I knew some paths I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to do the West Highland Way. I knew I wanted to do the Great Glen Way, the South West Coast Path, the Severn Way, loads of canals, and run through the Lake District. So I kind of knew roughly the bits I wanted to explore that I hadn't explored before. And then just sort of when I'd done the West Highland Way, then I'd sort of look at the OS maps and decide, right, how I'm going to get to the next bit and you know, work out, you know, if I was ahead of time or behind time, like, could I add a little detour to somewhere interesting, or did I have to make up some miles? I tried to not plan too much because I think, you know, someone famously said, actually, if you, you know, with enough planning, you can successfully eradicate all adventure out of your trip. So I didn't want to do that, you know, I wanted to just sort of let things unfold naturally.
I mean, is striking a balance between what you're trying to achieve here, like the idea is you're trying to complete this triathlon and this is the final leg, but at the same time everything you do is this real ingrained sense of adventure. So is that, did you ever feel the pressure to com- complete it quicker than you wanted, or was it always just, I need to just explore?
No, certainly. I mean, there's a lot to be said for, you know, it's all about the journey, not about the destination. But truthfully, a lot of the things I do is certainly revolves around getting to the finish line. You know, I'm actually not a very good wanderer. I'm not very good at holidays where I just sort of wander around and explore places. Yes, I want to have that element within my adventure, but certainly for me, the ultimate goal is crossing the finish line. And I guess I enjoy the racing side of adventure, but seem to somehow kind of come up with these ridiculously long races that only I ever do. So I'm basically just racing myself because no one else could be bothered to do them.
Well, you're guaranteed a win.
Yeah, well, exactly. Well, not always.
Oh, true.
It's pretty wild and then I get injured.
That's true. So do you think the way that you changed your approach to life and the fact that you took yourself off for a bike ride and it sort of went from there, really, how do you think modern lifestyle can be adapted so that anyone can fit their own adventure in?
I mean, depending on where you are in life, you know, I personally needed to take a big leap and do just something ridiculous and bonkers just to get my confidence back, just to feel a bit of fire in my belly about life because I was pretty miserable. But you definitely don't need to do that. You know, there's a couple of simple things you know you can think about. You know, your day should be, and I know this is woefully impractical at most times, but your day should be divided into 8 hours work, 8 hours sleep, 8 hours play, if you can. And I appreciate that a lot of the playtime gets filled up with day-to-day remedial activities like washing and ironing and doing the dishes, shopping and commuting and all these things, unfortunately, that eat into that. But nevertheless, you know, there are ways you can actually maximize that 8 hours of playtime. But, you know, one, I don't have a TV, so I haven't had a TV for 3 years, and that frees up my evenings. I tend to go to bed early, and I tend to wake up before 6 every day, which gives me 3 hours in the morning before I have to work. And then, you know, that, again, is a great way of adding more adventure. So in the mornings, I sort of take the dog for a walk and go for a run or a bike ride and then make a nice breakfast. And actually sets me up nicely for the day, having that bit of outside time before sort of having to start work. But then again, you know, sometimes you do need to just go off for a couple of weeks and sort of get a real life detox, you know, because real life, you know, the reality is we do lead busy, stressful lives, looking at computer screens and on the, you know, commuting and doing remedial stuff like the dishes. Whereas sometimes it's nice just to go away, have a challenge in mind, and train for it and then go off and complete it. And when you come back, you definitely feel like you've been properly recharged, you know.
I think it's important. I think a lot of people tend to get stuck in a routine that can, breaking that can make a big difference to just how happy they are. And, you know, the mental health side of running is a much talked about side of running. And I think, you know, lots of people take great solace in the fact that a little run can make all the difference.
Well, totally. And, you know, I'm a firm believer. If you're feeling a little bit down and a bit miserable, whatever, if you try and do three things: one, eat healthier, get fitter, and spend more time outside, so in natural lighting, you will get better and you will feel healthier and happier. And the way to do that is just to have a physical challenge that you're aiming for, you know, whether it's a park run, a, you know, half marathon, marathon, whatever you're into or you want to go for. Just put that goal into your life, and all of a sudden you'll naturally get fitter, you know, eat healthier, spend more time outside, and everything else. I really truly believe that everything else falls into place, you know.
Absolutely. I think quickly, just on the side of the kit, when you were, because you were hauling everything around on yourself and the whole adventure was unsupported, how did you manage to whittle it down to sort of key running kit that you needed whilst trying to tackle the length of Britain?
Yeah, a self-supported run really is so much more difficult when you're doing it with a rucksack. If a buggy is definitely a better way to do it, but then you're stuck to the road. So I wanted to be able to do the trails. So yeah, it was tough. I mean, I really go minimalist. I had to take one set of clothing, and try and wash them. Once a week, I'd treat myself to a hotel, and I'd use the free shampoo to get the stink out of my clothes, pretty much. And then I had really super light tent, super light sleeping bag, super light camping mat, a little stuff sack, which I'd put some clothes in as a pillow at night. I bought pairs of trainers when they ran out, when my trainers would last me, because I've got the rucksack and the extra weight, probably about 300 miles. So I found a running shop and bought a second pair en route, and then a third pair down in Somerset. A little battery bank to keep my phone charged for navigation and taking photos and videos and things like that. I took some tape just for my knees, some wet wipes, because that was my closest thing I'd get to a shower, pretty much.
Nice.
And I think a pair of gloves at the beginning, because it was snowing in Scotland, and which I then got rid of as I went down. So, yeah, you really don't need as much as you think you need, just to keep it simple, mainly just to keep the weight down, you know?
So, I mean, it's a very stripped-back sort of affair, but did you find that, and with any of your adventures, but particularly this one, that money, having money and setting forth on an adventure like this, are the two things necessary? Do you need money to make these things work?
You definitely don't, 100%. You know, you could do these things for free. There's actually a really good book by a guy called George Mahood who did, it's called The Penniless Adventure, and he did Land's End to John O'Groats with no money, and every day he was sort of going into a pub asking to wash the dishes if he could have a meal, you know. And, which is great. It was really, really fun. And but depending on it is, you know, some things do just cost money. You need to buy food, and you often need to get to and from Land's End or John O'Groats on a train and or a flight or whatever. But inevitably, they don't cost nearly as much as you think. I've actually sort of done some walks around Britain and lived on a fiver a day, actually, which is just, you know, I had a little jet boil and bought bags of pasta, a bit of pesto and a bit of chorizo for a bit of protein. And, you know, for a fiver, actually, that gives you the calories you need for a whole day. And I had a water filter just to fill up in rivers. So, you know, and that's in Britain. You know, you can probably halve that in many other countries if you're willing to find the right stuff to buy and things like that. So, yeah, no, you certainly don't need nearly as much as you think you need.
I think that's probably, it's very interesting here. I think a lot of people probably take the cost as to be a great sort of barrier of ever trying to achieve, do these things. I think I would think of it as a great expense, but really, it's quite a simple existence for a few weeks.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think my whole run, which is 6 weeks, I think probably cost me about £1,000, which, you know, it's still £1,000. It's still £1,000. But, you know, I think most people should be able to find ways of sort of saving £1,000, whether it's, you know, just buying one less pint a week or, you know, buying a cheaper version of something, X, Y, Z. There are always ways of trying to save that little bit of money. Or if you can't, or if you find that's too much of a stretch, then you just do what George did. And, you know, as you go, try and get put to work and wash people's dishes and things like that, which is, again, will become a really great adventure to look back on, I think.
For sure. I think, finally, Sean, most people want to know what the current length of the beard, and how well-maintained it is at the moment.
Right now, and you can probably hear it's a bit windy, I'm on the west coast of Ireland, cycling around Ireland, and it's freezing cold. Another beast from the east has come through, just my luck. So the beard is properly windswept. It's pretty long. It's probably nearly a foot long now.
Wow.
It actually goes up over my eyes when I've got a tailwind and it flips it up in front of me. So that's kind of dangerous on the bike, on the downhill. But it's actually a bit shorter. I've just got a little puppy. I got a Lakeland Terrier because they're really good at running. And he's now got into the habit of chewing the bottom of my beard.
Right.
So, yeah.
So that sort of naturally keeps the length.
Exactly, yeah. He's my barber.
Right, perfect. That's great. Well, thanks so much, Sean, for joining us. That was really, really interesting. And it just makes me feel like I should go for a little adventure, actually.
Well, you should. And actually, you know, my Running Britain book, it does detail all the routes and where I took. So if anyone wants to sort of do a run in a Land's End to John O'Groats run, read the book, and you'll make your life much easier because you won't make the same mistakes I did. So good luck.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
Well, always really great to hear from Sean. I really enjoyed that. I think the idea of having your own adventure as well chimes with us, because obviously by the time this comes up, we will have done the London's Peaks Relay, which is, for those who don't know, it's a London-wide relay taken in the highest point in each London borough. How are you feeling about it, Ben? Are you feeling ready to take in a few peaks?
Yeah, very much so. Really excited, actually. We had the planning meeting the other night and gathering together fellow runners. The relay team was looking very strong.
Yeah, a lot of lean people in that room. Yeah.
Lots of fast people. Staring at a map on the wall and all, you know, wistfully thinking about how we're going to tackle our little legs. It was good.
Yeah, it is. And I think, like Sean was saying there, I mean, it's very DIY. I mean, we've got a support vehicle that's a kind of minibus from the local church, I think, that we've called in a favour from. So it is very much like, as you're saying, being resourceful. I think Sean's website says something like, adventure is a state of mind. And actually, I like that, the idea that it's actually the kind of the imagination you bring to even a familiar place like London that can actually create an adventure. You don't need to throw, you know, loads and loads of money at it.
No, exactly. I mean, look, I mean, Sean, everything that he's done of that everyone knows he's famous for has been Britain. He hasn't.
Yeah,
he hasn't. I mean, he's been to other places, but people know of him as the guy who swam the coast of Britain, and he's now just completed this triathlon. And, you know, he could go and do it in somewhere much more exotic and it'd be more interesting for him. But the idea is that on your doorstep is these amazing places.
Exactly, exactly.
And I think that just starting in the city that we live in is kind of a great place to begin, and hopefully others will see that has real potential to do it in their own area.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Adventure begins at home. That's the message. And, yeah, well, hopefully, like you say, we'll try and inspire some other people to have a go at a similar adventure in their own city.
Exactly.
Great.
For more from Runner's World, head to runnersworld.co.uk.
If you didn't think riding 3,000 kilometres was hard, then how about running it? That's what marathon runner Peter Thompson is attempting as he takes on the entire route of the 2018 Tour de France, raising thousands of pounds for mental health charities. I caught up with Peter to find out a little more about the challenge. Well, Peter, thanks a lot for coming on the Runner's World podcast. I think, you know, to start with, how did you come up with the idea of running the Tour de France route?
It's a race that I've sort of been watching and really got into for the last 4 or 5 years. And it's just an amazing sporting event. So I was just watching it last year and I thought, I wonder if I could run it. And and as stupid as that idea sounds, it kind of stuck in my head and then never left, really.
I mean, it's a seriously long way, isn't it, even by bike? It's over 3,000 kilometres. I mean, how are you training for such an epic challenge?
You're right, yeah, it's over 3,000 kilometres. So I'm at the moment sort of training sort of every day, running-wise. I'm doing sort of 3 sessions in the gym for my legs, just in terms of preparation for running uphills and predominantly the downhills, which scare me just as much as the uphills, really. So, yeah, I'm doing sort of 80, 90 miles a week and just trying to get as prepared as anyone can be, really, I guess.
And my understanding is that you're going off with quite a large time before the cyclists and hoping to finish before they catch you up. Is that right?
Yeah. So I want it to kind of be a race against them. I think that's a really kind of key part of the challenge because it will keep me focused, I think, when I'm struggling. So the plan is to start 7 weeks before they do, and to finish sort of 2 days before them. So if I managed to do that, then that would be 70 days to do the challenge, which is, yeah, sort of 30 miles, nearly 50 kilometres a day, which, yeah, saying that out loud is quite scary.
Yeah, because it's not famous for being sort of pancake flat, the course of the tour. Lots of the climbs are very, very, very difficult, even on bike. Is that the kind of part that is that you're finding most daunting at the minute?
It is, because I'm not someone who's done loads of hill work and stuff in the past. I mean, I have my family near Mont Ventoux in France, and I have run up Mont Ventoux before, so I have got some experience of running up, you know, a big climb. But that's the biggest unknown for me, and it's the biggest unknown is how that's going to affect my body, both, you know, both the inclines and coming down, because I think it's the equivalent of going up Mount Everest over three times in terms of the climb. So It's going to be, you know, it's going to be an experience, but I'm hoping that the views on the way up will help.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess one thing the tour is famous for is the kind of crowd support and people out on the streets. But I guess when you're doing it, it's going to be much more isolated an experience. Is that right?
It will. It will. I mean, I've got my my girlfriend's coming with me, and she's kind of driving a car and hopefully doing some cycling. And then I've got some friends and things that are coming out on different sections. But there will be vast amount of time where I'm going to be on my own with my own thoughts in my, you know, in my head, and it's going to be those moments that are the really difficult bits. And I did a challenge last year where I ran a marathon in every country in Europe in consecutive days, and I was largely on my own for a lot of that, and it is those bits that really test you, because it's where you go to in that moment. It's the fact that you know you're going to have those doubts, you're going to have those moments where you think, can I do this? And it's almost knowing you're going to have those and expecting them, and then trying to deal with those when they come. And it's just as much a mental battle as it will be a physical. And I'm aware of that, but it will all unfold, I'm sure.
I mean, what will motivate you in those moments, Peter? I know that you're obviously raising money for a couple of charities. I mean, could you tell us a little bit about the motivation behind this challenge?
Yes. So the reason the challenge is called Marathons for the Mind. So that was the name of my last challenge as well, and I guess the name of the kind of initiative which I feel like that I've developed, and it's about raising money for mental health charities, basically. So one of those charities is Mind, and the other one is Livability, which run a particular garden project called Flourish near where I work in Poole. And both of those charities do some incredible work, and they make a difference to people's lives. And I link in with one of those charities through my job, and I see firsthand, you know, the difference it makes. And the mental health aspect, it's something that affects, you know, my friends and my family. And from the last challenge, it's very much made me understand my own mental health better, and the fact that I think we can all benefit from just being more open about our mental health in terms of listening to other people and being able to express what we might be feeling down. So I want to raise money, I want to raise awareness, and that is a huge part of this, and that motivation is in my head, and I've got so many people that I can think of and causes that I know it's going to make a difference for, that will be that I can turn to when I need to.
I was wondering if anyone had ever done this before, because it doesn't sound like the kind of thing that's on most people's bucket list.
a lady did it, Kazoe Romano, in 2013. So yeah, unbelievable. She did it in, I think, just under 80 days. She set off 6 weeks before the ride. She didn't plan to finish just before then, because of the way the route worked, she had to go back and finish another section. But I mean, it proves it can be done. And she was an incredible person for achieving that. And she raised hundreds of thousands of pounds for charity. So that will be a motivation as well, to know that somebody's done it. It will make it easier. My last challenge, nobody had ever done it before. And I guess it was that, if nobody's ever done it, you think, can you do it? And I guess to know that somebody's done this will help, I think.
Is there any particular stage that is kind of stands out for being particularly difficult, or one that you're looking at?
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Looking forward to?
I think sort of Alpe d'Huez which is just one of the iconic climbs in France, really, and it's one of the iconic climbs that the Tour goes up. So I'm really looking forward to going up that and just generally just getting to the Alps, because I know they're going to be hilly, but I think that kind of scenic aspect of it will help break that up. So there's some incredible climbs through the Alps and the Pyrenees, and you know whether my mind will change when I get there and I see how big they are in reality. Who knows? But yeah, I think those Alps and Pyrenees stages are the ones that stand out for me.
I mean, what happens, Peter, if it doesn't go as well as you hope, and the riders do catch you up? What's the kind of, how will you deal with that? Will you be kind of run down?
What I learned from last time is that you can do all the preparation in the world, and you can want something as much as you want, but you never know quite what's going to happen. There can be things that are taken out of your control. You know, I know mentally I'm very strong in terms of pushing myself, but there are some things you physically can't overcome, and I will obviously do all my best to overcome them. But you know, if I get overtaken, or if you know the challenge falls apart in 2 days because I hurt myself, I will have tried. I'll have put myself on that start line, and I think that's the biggest thing sometimes. Because I think people who sometimes want to do things but they don't because they think, what happens if it goes wrong? But I think getting to that start line, and I would say that to anybody who undertakes challenges, and anybody who has undertaken a challenge, you know, will understand that getting to that start line is a huge part, because there are a lot of elements, both logistically, training-wise, and everything else that go into standing on that start line. So it's an achievement just to get there. And what happens. And if I achieve it, then amazing, and I'll do everything I can. But if I don't, then I'd like to think that I'll have, you know, a level-headed mindset. And yeah, Obviously I'll be disappointed, but I will. You know, adjust as things go on, really.
I mean, we look at lots of the Tour riders, and they have a great team around them, that they have domestiques and all the rest of it. I mean, what kind of team will you have? I guess it will be slightly more of a kind of solo effort.
It will. It'll be my girlfriend in an estate car, basically. So, she'll be amazing, and the plan is to stay in kind of B&Bs and campsites along the way. But no, I don't have a team of physios and a big 4x4 following me around. So I've got a physio which helped me last time, and he's amazing, called Tim, and I can, you know, phone him up and he will help. And as I say, I've got friends who are coming out in different sections, so hopefully, like the team time trial, there'll be a few of us doing that one. But yeah, I think certain things go wrong. I haven't got this entourage, but that's part of the challenge, really. And you know, realistically, I'm only in France. I'm not in the middle of nowhere. So if I need certain things, you know, I'd hope that we can get hold of those.
Sure. And just remind us all when you're setting off and when you're hoping to finish.
So it starts on May the 19th. So yeah, that's Saturday, which is 9 weeks before. No, sorry, 9 weeks. 7 weeks before the riders start, and the plan will be to finish on the Friday, 2 days before the Tour finishes, which I'm pretty sure the Tour finishes on the 29th of July, which is a Sunday. So yeah, it will be 70 days. It will be 30 miles a day. And yeah, I'm massively excited. I'm scared as well, but the money has started to come in. We've raised £1,000 so far for the charities, and all the information about why I'm doing it and about the routes and all those things is on marathonsforthemind.com, which is my website and things.
No, I think it's an absolutely incredible challenge. I think it really captures people's imagination. It's not something that people probably think is even possible to run. So I think it's it's a fantastic thing to take on. Great. I mean, just final question, Pete, if that's all right.
Yeah, of course.
What kind of message are you looking to put out through this?
I think the message is about just wanting, first and foremost, in terms of the mental health aspect, is to get people to be a bit more open about their mental health, and to also listen to others and be open in terms of listening. So I think that kind of mental health focus is a huge thing. And in terms of the running aspect, it's trying to get people outdoors and hopefully inspire people to want to run, and to try and do that in, yeah, like a simplistic form, and just to kind of take it for what it is and the beauty of what running is. Because for me, running is a huge focus, to be able to go out and just put on a pair of trainers and explore the world and not have to, you know, overanalyze things, and to just to kind of enjoy it. And I would want to give people that message, and also, yeah, and completely the mental health message in terms of being more open and just getting people talking.
Peter, thank you very, very much for coming on the Runner's World podcast. Really interesting to hear a bit more about your challenge, and best of luck with it. We'll be watching it with interest come May 19th.
Cool. Thank you very much for having me.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
How has your running been going, Ben? You've got the London Marathon coming up.
Yeah, I do. It's still technically happening. I've had a bit of a knee injury, which has been carefully assessed by some of London's finest physios. But yeah, it's never say never.
What's the diagnosis?
Well, initially it was MCL, maybe some sort of cartilage,
right,
damage. That's probably down at the dramatic end of the scale. But there's definitely something on the medial side, on the inside,
right,
of the knee, which isn't quite doing what it's meant to do.
So what do you think chances are of making the start line at London?
I don't know. Oh, now it's probably more psychological rather than anything else. I'm trying to sort of get my head around the fact that I've missed 4 weeks, 5 weeks of training. So the idea of being on the start line and it being hard, much, much harder than I wanted it to be, is kind of where I'm at with the head. I think that physically doing it is still would be very difficult but doable.
Mm.
But whether or not I want to put myself through it, and also if someone tells me, like, oh, no, don't do it because your knee will explode, then I need to probably be a bit more sensible.
Yeah, I think with a serious injury, then it's
yeah, yeah, yeah. Until someone says that, though, then, yeah, all systems go.
Okay, well, we'll see how it goes.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Do you ever want to talk about your running?
Sure, yeah, I'll tell you about my running. What do you want to know?
Well, you're the one who does it, like, way more efficiently and better.
Okay, yeah, no, my running, so...
Rick.
Yeah.
And what about you, Rick? How's your running going?
Well, thanks for asking, Ben. Yeah, I did the big half, actually, so at the beginning of March. First half marathon I'd done for ages. Until this year, I was doing a lot of running with Hernhill Harriers. I was quite used to sort of working quite hard once or twice a week. So it was a big shock to go back and race and actually be like that kind of panicked right on the red line, like I'm probably going too fast and I'm going to blow up here. But it went all right. I did 1:24:59. So I think when you get 59 anything, that's very satisfying.
Generally anywhere the other side of an hour and 30 is ridiculous.
Yeah, well, I think it's a good watermark time, isn't it?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I mustered a sprint finish because I don't run with a watch, actually.
Right.
I think... it holds me back. No, I just don't. And I thought, oh, God, I might be quite close to under 1:25, which is way faster than I thought I'd do.
Yeah.
And then I saw it come in at 1:24:59. So hey. I thought, that's... So if there's a message there, it's do the sprint finish. It can be worth it.
For more from Runner's World, head to runnersworld.co.uk.
So we're very happy to welcome to the studio Runner's World commissioning editor Kerry McCarthy. Kerry's the in-house expert on running gear, so we thought with the spring marathons around the corner, it'd be useful to ask Kerry for some expert wardrobe advice. Welcome to the podcast, Kerry.
Morning.
So with a marathon coming up, what are the kind of kit do's and don'ts people should be thinking about?
Oh, so many, so many. It's enormously complicated and you're probably going to get it wrong. So start worrying now. No, not really. It's basically a question of common sense. For example, the one that all listeners predict that I'm going to say first is don't wear new shoes on the day or, in fact, at any point in the month leading up to it. I think every year, when we are at the Marathon Expo and we're manning the Runner's World stand and we see people who are running in 3 days' time with a couple of boxes under their arms looking proud, saying, I'm going to wear these on race day.
I did that once, actually.
Yeah?
To my shame, yeah, it was 2 days before and I'd been eyeing up these shoes and I thought, this is going to make the difference. And it was an appalling decision and I did a really bad marathon. I'm not blaming the shoes, but it was, yeah.
It kind of sounds like you are blaming the shoes, right?
Definitely just blame the shoes.
It wasn't my lack of any sort of 20-mile run, it was the shoes. But yeah, I fell into that trap, which I feel quite embarrassed about, actually. But there you go.
Yeah, well, you know, we all do it. I mean, I've been at run as well for 10 years and 2 weeks ago I went out for a 16-mile run wearing a pair of wet shorts straight from the washing machine. So, you know, I was walking like John Wayne for a couple of days afterwards. It wasn't pleasant. You know, we all make schoolboys. What else? Let's see. I think you need to apply that same principle to the rest of your kit. So don't worry about colour coordinating it. don't worry about buying something spangly new. Just wear the same tried and trusted outfit that you've worn in training on your long Sunday runs and that you know is going to work for you. Ultimately, nobody's going to care if you're wearing a coordinated unicorn outfit, Brooks Special Edition or whatever. They're just going to look at your race time and go, bloody hell, that was fast. And these kind of marginal gains in terms of wearing something where you don't even realise you're wearing it, just getting your kit out of the way, making it one less thing to worry about in the day, is important. In terms of what you should wear, if you're thinking, oh, I haven't really thought about my kit and I just wear my same Gola trainers and my cotton T-shirts, you obviously want something that's going to wick the sweat away, that is fast drying, that's lightweight. I think in some, most women, in my experience, will wear leggings, in which case I'm going to use the word gusset now.
Nice.
Make sure there is a gusseted crotch, which means it's kind of ergonomically designed for round those bits and not just like super tight.
Right.
Make sure actually that your leggings, you invest in your leggings so that they're kind of, they've got different panels on them to suit the cut of your leg. And again, so that it doesn't feel like you're just wearing cling film wrapped around your legs. For guys, shorts is almost certainly going to be the order of the day. It's entirely up to you whether you wear ones that have lining in or not. But again, don't wear new shorts because the lining is going to cut you to ribbons. And more people now are wearing, males and females are wearing sports-specific underwear. If you're thinking, I've never heard of this, then check out Runderwear, which is a specialist underwear brand. Check out Bjorn Borg, which, yes, is the ex-tennis pro.
Yep.
Who's gone into making his own range of kit, and he started off just doing underwear. There are several brands. My favourite one is the one called Two Under, which is an Aussie brand.
They should have called it Down Under, surely.
I think I remember reading something about the fact that they did, and then they just thought that was a bit dodgy. However, they have managed to maintain the Joey pouch in there, which is what you rest your crown jewels in, and the front is extra reinforced with a no-drip tip.
Well,
make of that what you will.
Wow.
Yeah.
How about compression gear, Kerry? Because rumour has it that you did your first marathon and you were in a lot of compression gear. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't think that was me. I think that might have been Runners World Deputy Editor Joe Mackey.
Okay, right.
If you ever saw Cathy Freeman in that skin suit in the Olympics, that's pretty much what Joe Mackey likes to look like on even just a casual training run.
If it wasn't you and the compression, then was it you with the many, many gels?
Hmm.
Or was it with the... Weren't you injured? Didn't you have knee guards on or something?
Yeah, that's true. My first marathon, I did turn up looking a bit like kind of like a sporty RoboCop. I had no clue what I was doing. This is like 16 years ago or something. And I'd overtrained and I arrived at race day wearing knee supports on both knees, elbow guards for some reason. I obviously thought I was taking part in a roller derby, and a camelback. And a baseball cap. And I just, yeah... It was mildly uncomfortable even to walk in, so God knows how I thought I was going to get around 26.2, but I did somehow.
Well, it's interesting on the camelback front, because I was going to ask about carrying a water bottle and hydration, that stuff. Do you think that with a well-organised big race like London Marathon, there's a need to be carrying lots and lots of water with you?
I think it depends what you're used to. If I would say carry your own water for one of two reasons. One, if you are going for a very specific time and you're trying to knock... let's say seconds. Let's say you've run 3:01 and you're trying to just dip under 3. Okay, you're going to be carrying extra weight on your back, but the time that you save by not slowing down to go through fuel stations and trying not to slip over banana skins and empty water bottles, if you know you've got everything on you, you can just cruise through the middle of all the fuel stations and that will save you time. And number two, if you've practiced with drinking something like a high carbohydrate drink, easiest drink than it is to say, then you might want to take that with you. You know, it's another one of the basic tenets of sports nutrition, that you don't try anything else new on the day. If you've been using brand A and then you brand B is what they've got, you're potentially letting yourself open to a world of gastrointestinal issues, let's say.
Nice. Have you ever experimented with making your own gels, Ben? I wonder if that's something you've ever done.
No, I mean, I think definitely like the cooked goods. So on runs, like I quite like eating.
What, like crystal meth?
Yeah, exactly. I like to start every 5K with a quick... No. But, you know, coming off of the world of cycling, preparing little bits of food for when you're out on a ride. Right. The same principle when I'm on a run. I don't mind chewing. I mean, like Cliff Bars, I'd eat a Cliff Bar on a run. So I've definitely made sort of chewable little flapjacky things, or like date balls and that kind of stuff, rather than gels. I don't mind a gel, but no, I've never made my own gel, which would be. Have you?
I have actually.
Why do you think he asked that question? Yeah, he's been gagging to tell us.
The rickpearsongel.com. No, I did. I looked into it, and it was basically bananas, honey, raisins, and just to be poncy, some chia seeds, all in a blender. Yep. And actually, it worked fine. Yeah, it was all right.
I will tell you, though, the benefit of having a child, among many benefits, is actually the pouches, baby food. The baby food pouches are ridiculously good.
You see a lot of ultra runners like pack those as well, because they're easy to pack.
I've taken them out on runs because you can get the ones which are like pretty, like just fruit, really good, no sort of extra, because you know they're for children, so they're meant to be good for them. And you just have one of those when you're running along, and it's kind of better than a gel. I mean, gels are great for that immediate fructose, sucrosey, whatever sugar you need, carb level. But if you're sort of happy to digest some baby food, I would absolutely recommend one of those.
Wow.
I mean, I wonder how much different they are in composition, like, you know, professional sports brand X and a bit of Cowangate. I mean, at a fundamental level, they're just going to have fructose, glucose.
Yeah, it's sugars, right?
I mean, massive sugar hit. I mean, as far as that goes, actually, I did try to, for London Marathon last year, I tried to take more natural fuel on the run, so like little energy balls made with like dates and bits of nuts and stuff like that. And it just did not work for me at all, which I was gutted about. And then when I talked to a couple of nutritionists about it, they said, well, that makes sense because you've been feeding your system with instant hit sugar, like simple sugars, for years, and that's what your system requires now. And you're trying to give it something that takes longer to digest, a slower release. And their theory was that it would probably take me 6 to 9 months to like adjust my insides to kind of like treating that as fuel.
Well, the reason why gels work is because all the blood is in your limbs, and your stomach has very little blood in it, so you put a gel in which is super condensed energy and whatever, is very easy for a blood-starved digestive system to process, essentially, rather than a large baguette, which is the other option.
Yeah,
obviously.
Then it's like but we ain't giving your stomach any blood to help with it, so exactly. It can just sit there.
Yes.
As regards other tips for kit, this is just a kind of, this is hopefully going to be a helpful tip, but seeing people doing it poorly is a bit of a bugbear of mine, which is that when you see people racing in cold conditions, and, you know, a lot of people know now to put bin bags on before the race or wear disposable clothing. But I think the disposable clothing thing applies to during the race as well. People quite often during a cold race, they will dress according to how cold they are on the start line and not according to how they're going to feel at mile four. We did a couple of pieces about a year ago at Runner's World on training and in extremes, not extreme conditions, but very cold and very hot. And we spoke to an academic at the University of Roehampton who explained that when you start running, even if it's just you change from a walk to a gentle jog, your metabolism will boost by up to 30 times. Right. So that's why, when, you know, you see at mile four of a marathon, people are running with like their jacket and their mid layer tied around their waist and it's flapping everywhere and it's clearly irritating them. And you think, oh, you poor sod, you've got another X miles to go. Really, if it's cold, wear some like cheapo $3.99 arm warmers, wear a knackered old gig t-shirt over the top of your race t-shirt. As long as you can show your bib, it doesn't matter what you wear over the top when you start. And still continue to shed layers as you go. And then once you've reached, you know, a few miles in and you've reached optimal temperature, you're going to kind of stay at that.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I heard a saying that was dress for the second mile. And I think that's, like you say, actually, if you're cold at the beginning and you're not moving, well, that's not going to be your state as you go.
No, you just, unfortunately, you just have to suck it up to start with. But just know, but have the confidence as knowing you are going to warm up very quickly.
Good chat.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I think, it's very rare that you find yourself cold during a race. I can't really think of any example I've ever had where I was like, oh, I wish I'd packed another layer here.
I've never ventured far enough afield for that to ever be an issue.
I wonder if we could talk just more generally about the marathon code? Because you're a bit of a kind of just beyond gear, but like with the kind of pacing aspect and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
I mean, how many London marathons have you run now?
Not sure, either 4 or 5.
Okay, so it's quite a lot, yeah.
Yeah, I think five.
Is there anything like, you know, any mistakes you've made or kind of lessons you've learnt through doing the marathon that amount of times that you kind of wish that you'd known when you started?
That's a good question. I think the one that gets me that I think is going to apply to a lot of people is don't get overexcited. Do not think on race day that you magically have the powers to run at 8 minute miles when all of your training has been done at 9 minute miles, because it's not going to happen. The number of times that, you know, when people come to us for marathon advice in the couple of weeks before and they say, well, I missed half my training. I wanted to run 3:30. I'm just going to go off at 8 minute miles and hang on for as long as I can and see what happens. You know, that way, painful disaster lies, frankly.
Not to be a harbinger of doom.
No, but you have to be absolutely realistic about your training. You know, most people are pretty in tune with their bodies. You know deep down what you're capable of at any given moment in time. So stick to it. And equally, if your training has gone very well and you have a plan, do not think, hold on a minute, that person up in front of me, I look like I'm a better runner than them. I'm going to take them. Their ass is mine. And then go through this whole thing of picking off people and thinking for the first few miles or the first half of the marathon, yeah, this is amazing, I'm smashing it. There's a reason why a marathon is 26 miles. And, you know, they say the marathon only really starts at mile 20. First 20 miles are just prep.
Yeah.
It's a 10K race, really.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. It's definitely the last 10K where things can go very right or more often very, very wrong. Steve Way, who obviously is a great runner, I think he ran 2:15 in London a few years ago. He said that he doesn't set his target time till very close to the race. For the reason you're saying, it might be that his training goes a lot better than he expects or a lot worse. And then he'll say, you know, 3 weeks out, actually, I'm going for this time rather than that time. I think in more amateur running, we just think, yeah, I'm a 3:30 guy, you know, or I'm a 3 guy, or I'm 4, whatever. And actually,
yeah, and it's so irrational, isn't it? Because you're a different person every day of the week, depending on what you've eaten, how your sleep's going, your workload, your stress, your everything, and all of these things have an impact. And so if you wake up, all right, you might sign up for the marathon in October, but by the time it comes to like the third Sunday in April and you're lining up on the start line, who knows what's happened in the 6 months or so, and certainly the 16 weeks prior to that.
Yeah, for sure. I think a lot of pressure that people put on themselves from that point of view, from the get-go. I'm doing this. In 6 months' time, I will do this.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, well, maybe, hopefully.
Yeah. And, you know, because they've put it out on social media and they've made a big thing about it and they've charted their journey, which all of which is good, by the way, obviously, because it's good to be accountable to people because it helps you to actually follow through on what you've signed up for. But you have to be able to cut yourself some slack as well.
For sure.
The other thing I've just thought of, which, again, we've covered in the magazine, which I don't know if you guys have tried it yet, but I have, and it definitely works, but it sounds a bit bonkers, is smile while you're running.
Okay.
I've been doing this. I agree. Yeah. I think it really
works. Don't you think it works?
I think it really works, yeah.
The research has been done that showing that if you smile when the going gets tough, A, it fools your brain into thinking, oh, I'm having a good time here, because our brains are that thick. Yeah. And also, it just relaxes a lot of the muscles in your body. And you know how tense you get in like your neck and your upper back and your arm swing. If you smile at tough points, actually, it feels different.
You see it with Eliud Kipchoge. He's got this kind of perma grin.
Yeah.
And it isn't just that he's particularly happy that he's the best marathon runner in the world. It's actually he's trying to relax himself.
I'd be that smiley if I could run as quickly.
Yeah, maybe that's right.
I'm incredibly fast and loaded.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you kind of feel like you're in control. If I'm smiling, I must be doing all right. I think, yeah.
I think going from the standpoint of don't do anything brand new on race day, are there any particular things you think that are acceptable on race day that you can do that is brand new kit-wise? Is there anything?
Kit-wise.
Do you know what? I'm really going to wear that lucky cap. Or, do you know, I mean, is there anything detrimental? Or is there something, or should people be putting, like, they've never ever put Body Glide on and then suddenly someone at the start line's like, share my Body Glide. I mean, it's a bit weird, but would you advise people who've never like used a
share
personal
my Body Glide? Sounds like a line out of Anchorman or something.
Well, thank
share
you.
My Body Glide.
Is that the sort of thing that you think actually, you know what, on race day, that's not a bad idea.
Yes, that's a good point, Ben Hobson. Let's talk about lubrication for a minute.
Yeah, that's true.
If you're thinking, oh, the conversation is going to get a bit dodgy now, it's not. If you don't know what it is, sports lube is basically a slightly more technical version of Vaseline. And most sensible people, if they're going on a long distance run, will put it on the parts of their body that are likely to experience chafing, which for guys is their nipples. For everybody should be their inner thighs, and around that general area.
Mm-hmm.
And also your feet, in between your toes, Achilles, anywhere that's likely to rub or you get blisters. You can certainly do that for the first time on race day. And in fact, I urge anybody who's listening to this, who is running a spring marathon, who hasn't previously done it, to get involved. It's going to open up your eyes to a world of pain-free running.
Between the toes?
Yeah.
I would have thought it made it kind of slippy.
No, it really doesn't, because these things are sophisticated enough now that it's not just like any old gunk.
Yeah.
And it reacts, and I don't know how it really works, but it reacts in a certain way with your skin, but it just means that you don't get any friction between the toes or any blisters or anything like that. It's fantastic. Let me see. Body Glide is a brand name for one of the best brands out there. And Two Toms, which is the number two, and then TOMS is another one. So I would check both those out. They are non-smelly. They don't stain your kit. They wash out easily and they get the job done.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
So that brings us to the end of this month's Runner's World podcast. I'd like to say a big thanks to our guests, Sean Conway, Peter Thompson and Kerry McCarthy.
For more info on running, training, nutrition advice and anything else that you might need for running, please visit runnersworld.co.uk. Thanks to everyone who's emailed the podcast at runnersworld.co.uk with all of your suggestions for topics. That's much appreciated. Please feel free to email us any more that you have. Tweet us as well at runnersworld.uk. Thanks very much for listening and see you next month.
The Runner's World podcast was recorded at Scramble Studios, Soho.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.